Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, streaming around the planet on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, and AirAmericaRadio.com. as well as CRN Digital. Welcome to our program. Our quote for the day from John Quincy Adams. Posterity, he's speaking to us. Posterity, you will never know how much it has cost my generation to preserve your freedom. I hope you will make good use of it. And that, of course, our obligation, and one of the people who's working really, 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 really hard out there to make sure that we do make good use of freedom here in the United States, and we keep freedom in the United States, Congressman Bernie Sanders, the longest-serving independent member of the House of Representatives in the history of that body, now running as an independent for the United States Senate. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders on the air with us. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466, all across the United States. If you want to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com. And Bernie's website, of course, is Bernie.org. Bernie Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you here, Bernie. The front page of the New York Times today is virtually a setup for my entire show here. I suspect for yours, too.
You know what it is, Tom? If you just look at the front page of the New York Times today, it does tell you why George Bush is regarded by the American people as the least popular and respected president in the modern history of America. And it really is frightening when you look at article after article after article, and see the repercussions of Bush's policy. We start off with two very tragic photographs, in the Middle East, of young Israeli soldiers weeping as they're burying one of their own, and then a picture of an eight-month-old Palestinian child being buried in the Palestinian Authority in Gaza City. And while it is certainly fair to say that, you know, the Middle East crisis was around long before George Bush took office, it is also fair to say that the war in Iraq has made a bad situation worse. On the front page of the New York Times, headline, Tide of Arab Opinion Turns to Support of Hezbollah. Arab fundamentalism, Islamic fundamentalism is growing. Very dangerous trend for world peace. And while Bush has been focused on Iraq, which is now becoming just such a tragedy, he has lost focus over the need to try to develop a peace process in the Middle East. So that's one story. Then you look right underneath it. In California, heat is blamed for 100 deaths. Well, once again, there have always been heat waves in America, but there is a great fear that as a result of global warming, we're seeing some very strange weather situations, whether it's the severity of hurricanes like Katrina and Rita, or the kinds of heat waves or the torrential rain that we have been seeing. And here is a president whose administration still refuses to acknowledge the severity and the huge catastrophic problems facing global warming and do what's right. In fact, right now in Congress, they're talking about an energy bill which still does not raise CAFE standards, still does not demand that automobile manufacturers increase the mileage per gallon that we get from our cars. Then you go to another story on the front page, headline, Drug Makers Pay for Lunch as They Pitch. This is a story that we've seen many, many times. Pharmaceutical industry is arguably the most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C., and is responsible for the fact that Americans pay by far the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. One of the things that they do is bribe doctors all over this country by providing not only, in this case, free lunch, they will take doctors, quote-unquote, on conferences to resort areas where they will talk about their products and get doctors to use their products. On Capitol Hill right now, we have the votes, Tom. We have the votes right now in the House, in the Senate, to pass prescription drug reimportation, which means that pharmacists, prescription drug distributors, individuals will be able to buy the same exact medicine that they're buying in the United States from abroad for a fraction of the price that we're paying right now, because the same product is sold abroad for much, much lower prices. If we do that, it will force the drug companies to lower prices in this country. We have the votes in the House, we have the votes in the Senate, but But because of the very large campaign contributions that the pharmaceutical industry has made to the Bush administration and the Republican leadership, we can't even get a vote on that, despite the fact there is bipartisan support and we have the votes. Then there's another little story. Front page of the New York Times. Oil prices help Exxon post $10 billion profit in this quarter. So there you are, folks. We're paying $3 for a gallon of gas. Well, not to despair. ExxonMobil has broken, once again, all the records in terms of oil profits. So, I mean, that's just a glimpse. And then you have an administration here, which, of course, refuses to demand that the oil industry stop ripping off the American people.
I'm amazed, Bernie, that the Republican leadership of the House and the Senate, which makes such hoopla about the free market and free trade and open competition and competition is a virtue, will not allow a vote where you say you have a majority of the House and the Senate.
Tom, I mean, we've had it. I've been a co-sponsor. In fact, has introduced legislation. I would say right now that if a reimportation vote came up in the House, we'd probably win 3-1. In the Senate, it is closer, but we now have put together a very good coalition. These are Republicans, conservative Republicans, who are arguing precisely your point. Hey, I believe in free trade. We could bring lettuce and tomatoes and grapes from Latin America, from Mexico, but somehow or another, we can't regulate a relatively small number of companies and warehouses to make sure that the drugs coming into this country are safe. Nobody believes it. Everybody knows that this is just an effort on the part of the pharmaceutical industry to make sure we pay sky-high prices for prescription drugs.
Yeah, I remember when you were first organizing in Vermont, busloads of elderly people to go up to Canada to buy pharmaceuticals, and everybody was going, "Oh no, you got to look out! Those are different drugs. They're from Canada." Turns out they're the same drugs.
Same drugs, same company.
And number two, we're not seeing all these Canadians dropping dead as they falling over onto the American border from taking Canadian pharmaceuticals.
I'll never forget this. I mean, you know, breast cancer is a terribly, terribly nasty illness, and women all over this country are fighting for their lives. We took a busload, and I was the first member of Congress to do that, took a busload of Vermonters over the Canadian border. And one of the reasons was just to let the whole world and the whole country know the absurdity of the price discrepancies between the two countries. Women went into a pharmacy in Montreal, and they purchased tamoxifen, which, as you know, is a widely prescribed breast cancer drug.
Yes.
You know what? Now, this is 5 or 6 years ago. Do you know what the differential in price was in American dollars for the same exact drug, tamoxifen? Take a guess.
2-1, 3-1?
Guess again, 10-1.
10-1?
Yes. And it was one-tenth the price. And the women there literally, I mean, I remember the look on their faces. These are people who didn't have a lot of money, struggling for their lives, paid one-tenth the price. Now, that may have changed over the years because the drug industry and the Bush administration are putting a lot of pressure on Canada, by the way, to make sure that Americans can't buy prescription drugs in Canada or elsewhere.
Right.
So here you have people fighting for their lives, in desperate need of medicine, can get it abroad for a fraction of the price, and there are the drug companies and the Bush administration. So, no, you can't do that. You have to pay 2, 3, 5, 8 times more in the United States of America.
And this really illustrates a larger issue, Bernie Sanders, and that is that, you know, as to paraphrase Greg Palast, we have the best Congress money can buy.
Absolutely.
Right now.
I mean, that is it.
And so what do we do about that?
Well, I mean, again, I want to get back to a point that you and I talk about almost every week, and that is, you know, people get discouraged, people get depressed about what's going on in Washington, and there's a lot of reason to do that, but don't give up on the process. We have the opportunity in 3.5 months to get rid of the most extreme right-wing House and Senate leadership that this country has certainly seen in our lifetimes. Are the Democrats going to do everything that we want them to do? No, they're not. But are they going to stop this extreme right-wing drift? Yes, they will. Can they pass, among other things, reimportation? Yeah, they can do that. Can they move us in a very different direction in terms of global warming? Yeah, they can do that. So, I mean, there's a lot of things that we need to do, and I hope that people stay focused on the most important issue, and that is to end one-party government in America. A government in which you have the House and the Senate essentially rubber-stamping the right-wing extremist positions of the Bush administration.
Yesterday I was talking on the program about how MoveOn.org has put together some commercials pointing out the relationship between some Republicans and the pharmaceutical industry. And Sinclair Broadcasting, among others, there's a number of television stations around the country that eagerly took money from Swift Boat Veterans for Truth and ran their ads, are refusing to run these ads. It's incredible.
This is a very dangerous trend that doesn't get enough attention. And it's not just, well, MoveOn had this problem before. When I think a couple of years ago they wanted to talk about Bush in the deficit,
yeah,
and some of the TV networks refused to run it. You know, what happens during a political campaign, the law is that if I put an ad on, they can't take it off. The bottom line is people should have the right to have their positions. If they're paying for these ads, have their positions appear on television.
Yeah, we're getting corporate censorship here.
Right.
It's a spooky
right.
thing. 16 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. I'm broadcasting today live from our affiliate WTKG, Clear Channel Station in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Our number 866-440-8466. We'll be right back.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I cleared the rocks and timber from the wild New England shore. I labored long and hard to make it grow. I built the first log cabins and I raised a family. Tolkien, George, and all his redcoats, where to go? I'm the man that built the bridges. I'm the man that laid the track. I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars. And I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
And welcome back. Yeah, let's remember who built America. It was the workers of America. 21 minutes past the hour. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us, the only independent in the House of Representatives, longest serving independent in the House of Representatives as well in the history of that body. And his website, bernie.org, our telephone number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. I'm Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from the studios of WTKG in Grand Rapids, Michigan, one of our affiliates, one of our longest. We've been on the air here on WTKG for, I think, 3 years. So just very pleased to be here. Bernie, let's pick up some phone calls here. John in Wayland, Michigan, you're live with Bernie Sanders.
Yes, welcome to Grand Rapids, Tom.
Thank you.
I'm in Wayland, about 25 miles south of you, and I've called before. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, John.
I have so much respect for you and the things that you're doing in our Congress.
Thank you.
I have a quick comment, maybe off in a little bit different direction. I was talking to a Republican friend of mine a couple weeks ago, and he was all frightened that Kerry was going to get in because that was going to make him register his guns immediately. He's a hunter. He doesn't have AK-47s and stuff, which I mentioned to him that a president can't pass a law like that, but to not much avail. But the conversation also led to the wiretapping of phones, and this same guy has no problem with the wiretapping of his phone because he's not doing anything wrong, so what's the problem? And if we apply that to the gun issue, if he's not doing anything wrong with his guns, then what's the problem?
So he trusts the government to regulate his gun, or to regulate his phone, but not his gun. Bernie?
Absolutely.
Bernie, you're
well, just a couple of issues. I mean, I've heard that as well. And it's disturbing, especially when you have a president who talks about freedom, freedom, freedom. To my mind, freedom does not mean that the government collects the phone calls that Americans make and assembles them in Washington. It means freedom does not mean that the government can tap your phone. I mean, what our Constitution is about is to say that everything being equal, people can do what they want to do. And if we have a reason to believe that somebody is breaking the law, we want to go after them. So needless to say, I strongly disagree with that gentleman, but I am concerned that a lot of people are saying, hey, what's the problem? Let the government look at my phones. I think that that's a very dangerous trend and leads us in the direction of totalitarianism.
Yeah, indeed. Paula in Des Moines, Washington, is that, or Iowa, Paula?
No, Des Moines, Washington, just south of Seattle.
Oh, I didn't know it was there. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I just had a quick question for Congressman Sanders. I keep hearing about, you know, people being denied prescription drugs because, and these are like life-saving drugs, because of the cost or because they can't get them from Canada. We've cut funding to the Veterans Administration for veterans health care. We've cut back funds for poor families. We've vetoed the stem cell research bill. And I guess, you know, I'm just wondering if there's some evil demonic plan to knock us baby boomers off really early to solve the Social Security program, to solve the Social Security problem, because it would seem to me that, you know, we're the ones that are going to really tax that system. And if we die earlier, then attrition will take care of some of the funding problems.
Well, no. Paul, I don't think so. I think it's not quite that demonic. I think it's more easily understood when we just look at the power of the pharmaceutical industry. Year after year, the pharmaceutical industry is the most profitable industry in this country. And whenever anybody in Congress tries to bring up legislation that would lower the cost of prescription drugs, we have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of well-paid lobbyists descending on Capitol Hill. The pharmaceutical industry spends huge amounts of money in advertising, campaign contributions. So I would look at it simply as a group of people who want to make absolutely as much money as they possibly can. They have been very, very successful in that regard. But I don't quite think that they want to knock off our generation.
So we don't have to worry about Soylent Green.
I wouldn't go that
down the road. Yeah. Paula, thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you. I appreciate it. Blaine in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. We have about a minute left before we have to take a break, Blaine.
Okay, I wanted to ask Bernie. I know he's had talked about the higher prices for drugs in the U.S. versus Canada, but in Canada, it's all state, you know, operated healthcare, and lawsuits are pretty much they don't exist out there. And I'm curious to know if our higher prices are the result of the legislative body's inability to put any caps on medical malpractice suits against the drug company.
Well, it's a longer story than we can answer in 30 seconds, Lane, but. What the Canadians do, and virtually every other government in the world does, is negotiate prices with the drug companies and say, okay, you can charge 3% more this year than you did last year. In the United States, uniquely, drug companies can charge any price they want. They can double the price on your drugs tomorrow for no reason whatsoever. That's the difference.
Yeah, and the malpractice lawsuits really have nothing to do with pharmaceutical prices.
Right. I think that's right.
Yeah. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, our Brunch with Bernie segment. Bernie.org is Bernie's website, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room. Our telephone number, 866-440-8466. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live from WTKG. We'll be right back.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And to right or wrong, and to weak or strong, it is known to scream from the wall.
My friends, 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. The program where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. The Tom Hartman radio program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org. Our number, toll-free across the United States, 1-866-440-8466. And Bernie, Mike in Baltimore, Maryland's on the line, wants to disagree with us about Iraq. Hey, Mike.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good, Mike.
Good. Hey, I'm listening to you on Sirius, by the way. I enjoy listening to opinions that don't agree with mine, just to kind of get a sense for the other side. But you said something a little while ago, Bernie, that inspired me to call, which was about how George Bush's, and I think you're right, actually, but about how George Bush's poll numbers are horrible and how he's the most, I can't remember what you said, the most distrusted president.
Unpopular is, I think, the word I used.
Yes. Yes, because of the Iraq thing, and you went on to say, sorry, help me out here.
Well, what's your point, Mike?
The point is that I think we're on the right track there. And I think that actually, I mean, you were saying it's worse than it ever was. The Middle East is a bigger mess than it ever was. And I agree with that. But I think the difference between liberals and conservatives on this issue is that we all, I don't think you're an idiot or any liberals, and you know, certainly respect your opinion. And I think that we all believe that there should be peace, but how we get there is where we differ.
Right, Mike. I mean, I think that's right, Mike. And all that I was saying, let me back it up a little bit. First of all, I think the record would show that actually George Bush is one of, if not the most unpopular presidents.
I agree with that.
Okay, and it's not, by the way, Mike, it is not just, I think Iraq is an important part of it, but it's not just Iraq, by the way. I
agree with that, too.
Okay, good. So we don't have to argue about that. In terms of the Middle East.
I'm a conservative, and I try to be reasonable about things and be, you know, kind of in the middle, but I disagree with a lot of things he's done. But anyway.
And I'm glad you're calling in, by the way, because I think it's important that we do have dialogue. People can have honest differences of opinion and not hate each other, you know, and so forth.
Absolutely.
And in terms of the Middle East, of course. I mean, no sane person does not want peace in that region, no matter what your political politics are, right? Of course,
right,
we
exactly.
all want peace. And it's not my view, obviously. This conflict has been going on for decades and decades and decades, well before Bush was president. I think the issue that I raised is that what the war in Iraq has done is a deflected attention away from the Israeli-Palestinian crisis and the need to get on a peace process there. And number two, inflamed the entire Muslim world and has helped lead to more Islamic fundamentalism, which I think is a very, very dangerous ideology. And I'm not sure how we're going to bring peace to the world or, in fact, be effective in fighting terrorism if you have millions and millions of people following the ideology of people like Osama bin Laden.
Well, I'll tell you, unfortunately, I can't totally disagree with your thoughts on that. But I mean, I guess what I think and a lot of conservatives think, and George Bush certainly thinks, is that this is the time to confront this issue. I don't think that Democrats really understand the nature of this battle. This is a war between good and evil. There are people that want to kill every single Israeli and take that state over. And same with America. They don't want anybody here to live.
Mike, let me just jump in and say, these guys, I'm not arguing with you.
Mm-hmm.
I think, what can we say about Osama bin Laden? He'd blow your head off tomorrow if he could, right?
Absolutely.
So we're not arguing. I don't think any sane person doesn't understand that. The question is, how do we defeat that ideology? And what I'm arguing is that it's tough stuff. I don't have any simple solution. But I think actions which bring recruits to Osama bin Laden's banner, when you have kids who are 15 years old willing to blow themselves up, killing Americans, so killing Israelis, man, when we have that process and that growth, we're losing that war. That's what my concern is, Mike.
But here's the difference. We can sit back like we have for several years now and take a little pop shot from them here and say, well, they only killed a couple people here. They only killed a couple people. And what we're living in is terrorism. It's not the people that are being killed that are being terrorized. It's the people that are living every day with the fear of being terrorized. And that's what I want to get rid of. I mean, I think it, confronting it now, making it a big issue, and I think you're right. I think there are some people that are being recruited by the evil ranks because of what we're doing. But I just think sitting by and trying to appease it and trying to...
Okay, Mike, but let me argue with you there. I don't think the alternative is not to do nothing. No one suggests that. If you're arguing that we've got to do something, you're right. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, let's sit back and think these guys are nice guys and they're not going to hurt us. That's not true. I've said time and time again on this show and publicly, I fear very much that there could be another terrorist attack against the United States. These are bad news guys.
Absolutely.
And we've got to be very aggressive in going after them. But the overall picture is, how do we defeat them? And I think the effort that Bush has been mounting has not been succeeding. That's my only point, okay? Mike, thanks a lot for calling up, okay?
Yeah, good to hear from you, Mike.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number, Joyce in Holland, Michigan. Hey, Joyce.
Hey. Boy, oh, boy, that guy ought to sign up and go over there and fight if he feels it's so conservative. That's not my question, but I get a little concerned about these people that think war is so wonderful, and they're sitting back here on a cushy job and have everything the way they want. My question is, Senator Bernie Sanders, I'm sure you...
We hope to be Senator.
I know it, but I like to call you Senator now. I always talk to my friends about tell them to listen to the show. Be sure to listen on Friday. And I wonder, if Ford from Tennessee and you both get in to be senators, how many more do we have to get in order to be the Democrats rule the Senate?
Well, if...
Along with the independent. I know you're an independent.
Right. If, and that is a big if the Democrats are able to control and to hang on to all of the seats that they now have, and I'm able to retain Senator Jeffords' independent seat, the Democrats need to win 6 seats that are now held by Republicans, because they're going to need 51 seats, because if it's 50-50, Cheney will, of course, vote with the Republicans.
I wish that you could pound some sand into some of these people that think that we don't have to control our borders first and have this guest worker and all this kind of baloney and give them all kinds of things. I'm 80 years old today, and I'm from Holland, Michigan. My name is Joyce Sherrill. And they call me a rebel rouser because I call the stations around here and give my opinion, which is very liberal. I believe in people being free.
Wow.
And
George,
I don't believe in free trade, but I certainly, Senator, I know you're a congressman, but I look forward to your election to the Senate.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Joyce. Happy birthday to you. And thanks for listening on WTKG here in Grand Rapids, which is where I'm broadcasting live from today. Jim in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Jim.
Thanks, Tom. Senator. You know, I'm not really worried about the terrorists. What really scares me is the news that come out from American Bar Association that this president violated the Constitution 800 times. See, this is what we worry about in America. We're not worried about all the reports about Al-Qaeda, 2,000 members, and Hezbollah, 3,000 members. You know, we have an army over there, and we're worried about little bands of hoodlums. You know, let's get elected. We have to worry about what the president is doing to this country.
Now, let me respond in two ways, Jim. Number one, I'm not quite sure that I agree with you. I do worry about Al-Qaeda, and I worry about Hezbollah. And you can have relatively, I think they have more than a few thousand members, but these guys can get dangerous weapons, and they are a threat to world peace, and they're a threat to Americans. But your second point is also a good point, and I think the American Bar Association and many others, my colleague Senator Leahy, the ranking member of the Judiciary Committee, have been raising this issue over and over again. Nobody in this country, not you, not I, not the President of the United States, is above the law. That is the heart and soul of what America is about. And we have a president who time after time signs legislation passed by Congress, and he says, I'm signing this bill, but by the way, I don't intend to enforce this section or that provision. That is not democracy. The Constitution says his job is to enforce the laws passed by Congress. He does not pick and choose. And this is just one example among many where you have a president who thinks that he has an imperial presidency. He does not have to obey the law. It is a very, very dangerous trend.
Dangerous for American democracy.
Absolutely.
As well. Tom in Minneapolis, Minnesota, you're live with Bernie Sanders. We have about a minute before we have to take a break.
Okay, Bernie, quickly. Your last conservative caller is a perfect example of what I'm going to say here. Language and slogans and the rove tactic. Bush bad, to give Republicans in Congress cover so conservative voters can feel good by saying, yeah, I know Bush is not a real conservative, but my congressman is a true conservative, and I'm still going to reelect him, so enabling Bush. That guy agreed with you, that call, yeah, Bush isn't real, but my congressman. We have to put the word Republican-controlled Congress. It's the Republicans. Don't say Bush administration, because Bush ain't running. 90 days to get the scarlet letter R in everybody's brain.
Okay, that's a very good point. That is a very good point. The issue right now, Bush is not up for re-election. It's control over the House, control over the Senate. It will probably, in both instances, come down to a few seats. If you do not like the direction in which this country is going, it's time to change congressional leadership, and that will happen in 3 months.
At the local level. And we all need to get involved. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org. If you want to drop into our live chat room, tomhartman.com will get you there. 866-440-8466, our number. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to the 6 o'clock news.
At 6 o'clock,
President Bush's surprise message. America is addicted to...
I must have dreamed a thousand dreams.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Our Brunch with Bernie segment. Congressman Bernie Sanders with us. His website, bernie.org. Our number, 1-866-440-8466. And Greg in Kalamazoo, Michigan. You're live with Bernie Sanders. Hey, Greg.
Yeah, I've got a comment and a question. My comment is, you know, the liberals have been accused of being soft on crime because they support civil liberties. But what people seem to forget is these liberties are not just civil liberties. These are guaranteed in our Bill of Rights, the Constitution, which is the basis of this country to begin with, and how people can say, oh, well, we really don't need this. We don't really care if people troll our phone records. There's no big deal when the right against illegal search is based on our Constitution. Nobody seems to know or care about our Constitution anymore. So that's my comment. And then my question is, based upon, I don't know if you remember the Rolling Stones issue by report by Kennedy, where he documents so thoroughly all the voting irregularities. What makes anybody think that with so little left to get the Republicans out, that we have any confidence that we're going to have honest elections?
Let me answer in both your questions. Mm-hmm. First of all, unfortunately, from way, way back, respect for our Constitution and respect for civil liberties and what our Constitution is about, what freedom is about, is in fact not deeply ingrained in our people. Tom, you'll remember, poll after poll, people used to read this, the Constitution or the Bill of Rights, and some people thought it was a communist conspiracy. Remember
yeah,
that?
And particularly the Declaration of Independence. I remember back during the Vietnam War, there was a famous study where they went out and asked people if they would be willing to sign it, and a majority of Americans said, no, this is a subversive document.
Right. So, I mean, I think we've got to do a lot better in our school educating our young people about what an extraordinary document this Constitution is and what freedom really means. So that's number one, and that's the long-term issue.
Bernie, can I toss something in here on that?
Sure.
One of the trends that I've noticed, because I've worked in education for years. I'm on the board of a private school. I've written books about education. And back in the 1980s, the conservatives associated with Ronald Reagan essentially declared war against public education, as you know, but they also declared war against the teaching of civics, and saying that it was, had a liberal bias, and started going after just basically the whole thing, the whole idea of teaching American history and teaching civics and teaching these kind of things. And so now, here, 25 years later, in many of our schools, kids don't study the Constitution. They don't study the Declaration of Independence. They don't study American history beyond just the few necessary talking points for No Child Left Behind. And I think that that's a big part of why we have a generation coming up that looks at what Bush does and goes, well, what's the big deal?
That's right. No, I think you're exactly right. And it's not only lack of familiarity with what our Constitution is about or the history of the Constitution. It's even lack of understanding about the political process. What does the United States Congress do? What is the function of the presidency? I mean, really simple, basic things. You would be surprised that a lot of Americans are just not familiar with those concepts.
Yeah, yeah. And the second point you were going to get.
I'm sorry, what was the second question was?
I've forgotten myself. So let's move on here. There's just so much going on today. 1-866-440-8466. Jim in Grand Rapids, Michigan, listening on WTKG, where I'm broadcasting from today. Hey, Jim.
Hi, Tom and Bernie. I just had to call and comment on a conservative caller who argued that the Middle East conflict is about good and evil. I just think it's a great strategy that Republicans like to use to simplify everything. And I think Democrats and progressives need to explain that things are more complex. A lot of these issues are more complex than just good and evil. It kind of reminds me of the whole fuzzy math argument that Bush used against Gore. When it wasn't really fuzzy math, it was just complicated math that Bush and the general public didn't understand, which is why we elect leaders who understand complex issues in the first place.
Well, Jim, you raise a very good point, and it goes certainly well beyond the Middle East. One of the things that's happened is that a lot of people get their information
from television sound bites, where you have to encapsulate your point of view in about 5 seconds. And it's pretty easy to say it's good versus evil. You can get that in 5 seconds. It's a lot harder to explain the reality of today's world and what we have to do and develop intelligent public policy. And that gets back to the media and the need to have the media start talking about the real problems facing America and real solutions. And sometimes, you know, you just can't do that in 5 second sound bites.
T. Jean in Seattle, Washington. You're live with Bernie Sanders.
Hello. I've got a question and possibly a follow-up. Bernie, have you actually read RFK's article in the Rolling Stone?
Have I read? I'm sorry, say that again.
Have you actually read the article that RFK wrote?
Oh, that RFK wrote. I read some of it. I did not read the whole article.
Okay. Why not?
Why not? Because
why?
Because there's a lot of stuff that I read, and I work about 60 or 70 hours a week, and we have a lot of issues to deal with, but I am familiar with this article. Yeah. What is your question?
My question was why you did or did not read it, and then what you thought of it if you had actually read it in totality. There's a lot of people on the chat who just wanted to know. So.
Okay. Gene, thank you. Bernie, we just have a few seconds left here.
Well, it's all, unfortunately, there. I am familiar with his thesis, but I have not read his entire article, and unfortunately I don't have time to read every single article that's out there.
Yeah, yeah. Understood. Bernie, final words?
Final word is let's focus on what's going to happen in 100 days or so and make sure we end one-party Republican rule over America.
Yeah, well said. Congressman Bernie Sanders, Bernie.org, his website. Bernie, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Always great to have you here. 57 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program. Coming up, conservative Neil McCluskey opposes a new bill to help send more kids to college. Hang on, as I'll be asking, doesn't democracy require an educated populace? We'll be right back.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Who should be going to college? Should everybody go to college? Should anybody go to college? Should it be an accident of birth? Should only the wealthy go to college? Neil McCluskey is with us. He's an education policy analyst at the Cato Institute, cato.org, the website. Hey, Neil, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good, good. You wrote a piece here, The Folly of Federal Policy, and in it you talk about how you see everyone is driven to maximize his or her happiness, or what economists call utility, and for students that means paying as little as possible for college. Why should students pay anything for college?
Well, the problem is if you don't have students pay anything for college, essentially what you're saying is taxpayers should cover the full cost of a college education, you would have massive inefficiency, because then everybody who wanted to be a student would have an incentive to consume as much education as they possibly could, whether they really need it or not, if someone else is paying the bill. And so you have to let the market work in education just as you do anywhere else if you want to have the most efficient distribution of resources, not just in education, but the economy as a whole.
Well, Thomas Jefferson, when he started the University of Virginia, which he felt was a more important accomplishment than his 8 years as president of the United States, and therefore asked that that be on his tombstone rather than the fact that he was president, when he started the University of Virginia, he did it as a free university. The only criteria was that you had to be able to deal with the classes. If you could handle the curriculum, you could go to school. And the whole point of it was to create a class-less society in the United States, or at least increase mobility among the social classes. And that's been one of the real strong ideals of America for a long, long time. It sounds to me, though, like what you're suggesting is that we should use money as the way of determining who gets into what schools, how, and when.
Well, I'll say two things. One is I hear Thomas Jefferson brought out a lot in education, but we have to remember he was a great man. He had a lot of really great libertarian ideas, unlike what's usually talked about in education. But what he wanted typically was not enacted, because most people, even in his day, realized that having government active in education, especially bigger governments like state and federal government, was a recipe for disaster. That's why it took him so long to get the University of Virginia, and he never got a lot of the K through 3, really, stuff that he wanted. The other problem is, I wouldn't say that anybody necessarily should dictate who goes to college or who doesn't. What I'm saying is that nobody through government should dictate what anybody does with their money, including saying that you, taxpayer X, must pay for student Y to go to college for X amount of years to study whatever that student, not you, the person paying for it, wants.
But if we want to have a functional democracy, Neil McCluskey, if we want to have a functional democracy in this country, I think that, you know, 200 years of fairly broad consensus from the founders to today, that you have to have an educated populace. And if education is beyond the means of a lot of people, I mean, right now, this is Department of Education statistics. The average student right now graduates from college with $27,800 in debt. That's 3.5 times what it was just 10 years ago. 84% of black students, 66% of Latino students graduate with debt. 39% of all student borrowers graduate with unmanageable levels of debt. And I'm sure you would acknowledge there's a large number of kids who are probably quite capable of going to college, and there's a very small number of scholarships out there, and who simply can't go to college because their parents don't have the money. There's a social good in providing free college education to kids.
Well, this is really the sort of the tragic part of what is really good intentions. I mean, when you say there should be universal access, your intentions are good, because you want people to have the access to an education that we think is valuable.
Well, and it works for all the European countries that do it, by the way.
Well, it doesn't, actually. I mean, you can read several recent articles about European university systems that are decrepit disasters because there is no competition. The government says, we'll supply everything, and then schools don't compete to put out the best products. But really, the tragic unintended consequence of how
Hang on just a second, Neil.
Sure.
I can't let that slide by. I'm sorry. I've lived and worked in Europe, and in most of the Western European countries, you can go all the way through the PhD, assuming that you can maintain, you know, a certain grade level for free. And it's paid for by taxpayer dollars. And what that does is it diminishes the social stratification. We in the United States have now surpassed the United Kingdom, which is arguably one of the most highly socially stratified countries in Europe. We have surpassed the United Kingdom in terms of the inability of people who are born in the lower middle class or the middle class economically to move into the upper middle class or upper classes economically. We are the most rigidly socially stratified, economically socially stratified country now in the Western world. And in large part, the evidence indicates that the reason for it is because education's so expensive.
Well, let me say two things, because I think I can address the same problem you want to address and help get more kids to college. But I do it a different way. But I also need to say that I also lived and worked in Europe, and I know that Europeans, A, would much prefer to go to an American university than one of their own, because we have such a great university system as a result of competition and not government bureaucracy. But the other thing is...
You'd say that to students at Oxford?
I would say that to students at anywhere other than Oxford or Cambridge. If you look at the list, international list, of the best universities in the world, you see Oxford and Cambridge from Europe, and just about everything else is in the United States.
Come on, Neil. There are some extraordinary universities. I'm forgetting the name of the University of Fichte, founded in Berlin, but I spoke there. I mean, there are extraordinary universities in Europe.
Well, I would just encourage you or your listeners to Google the top 10 lists for universities in the world, and you'll see that American universities always dominate.
And you're suggesting that this is because we charge money for school?
Yeah, it's because we let market competition work. And in European countries, they don't.
I'd say it's the other way around. What happens, what you've done is you've created a self-fulfilling prophecy. If the only way you can get into school is to have a lot of money in your pocket, then you're going to be coming from families that have a lot of money, which means that those families probably gave you a better pre pre-college education, a better primary and secondary education, private schools and things like that. And so you're more likely to have highly achieving kids. And those highly achieving kids are then going to be going to Princeton and Stanford and whatnot. And therefore, you're going to have better test scores and like that. You're creating a system that is a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, no, not really. I mean, we have a college system that actually addresses the needs of a large strata of kids. But not most of the middle class. I do agree that our colleges are, in many cases, getting priced beyond the means of a lot of people, or at least it's a huge burden on people. But the interesting thing about that is it's driven by the way we try and help people go to college. In other words, state government, especially the federal government, provides massive per-student subsidies. Now, in many cases, they also sort of curve that in the favor of the middle class because you can't pass something politically without including the middle class. And so with all these subsidies, of course, colleges charge more and more in tuition because the government is making sure that college students can pay more and that colleges will therefore charge more.
Well, then why is that not happening in Europe where the government's paying the whole bill?
Well, because in Europe they have the opposite problem. They don't charge the students, and therefore they have stagnant, non-innovative colleges that nobody actually wants to go to.
I would suggest that there's a very different dynamic at work here, Neil McCluskey, with Cato.org, the Cato Institute, and that is that because so many of our good jobs are being shipped overseas because of the insane trade policies of this administration going back to Reagan, really, that parents are increasingly hysterical about their kids getting college educations, as are kids themselves. They feel that that's, you know, if it's either flipping burgers or getting a bachelor's degree at least. And so getting a degree, so the demand for college education is increasing, and therefore the colleges, because there's a lot of demand, there's a limited supply, the colleges are able to increase their prices. I mean, I'm using your market argument.
Well, you know, to an extent, you're right, because we discriminate against colleges here that might be for-profit or something like that, which would be an encouragement for a school to expand its operation.
No, it's because we're not increasing the availability of college by increasing the funding available for it like they do in Europe, by saying, hey, you know, create more colleges here. We're going to send you more students. We'll pay for them.
But the problem is if you have the government do it, then you get heavily bureaucratized colleges that nobody wants.
Wait a minute. You've never seen a bureaucracy in a corporation?
Oh, there is. Nearly like you get from government. I'd suggest that you have your listeners look up just articles about higher education in Europe, and you'd find massive discontent with the university system because they are free and they don't innovate and they don't improve.
And I would encourage our listeners to look for articles about the middle class in America graduating from college with $40,000, $50,000 in student debt and having the first 5 years of their lives wiped out.
Well, I'd also suggest they look at how much more money they'll make over their lifetime as a result of that relatively small amount of debt when you compare it to earnings.
Okay, well, interesting conversation. Neil McCluskey, you can learn all about it over at Cato Institute, cato.org, his article, The Folly of Federal Policy. Neil, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Good talking with you. 16 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We've taken all you've given. It's getting hard to make a living. Mr. President, it's pity on the working man. We ain't asking you to love us. You may place your
Yeah, Mr. President, just, hey, pay some attention to the working man once in a while. It would sure be nice. 21 minutes after the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from the studios of WTKG, our affiliate in Grand Rapids, Michigan. And pleased to be here. Thanks to Phil and everybody else here for making all this possible. The whole issue, the whole argument, the whole debate about whether or not education should be available to everybody, regardless of the amount of cash they have, is, it, frankly, I think, one of the biggest issues in America right now that is not being talked about. And we'll be talking about it more after the next break, and we'll be taking your calls on it. But right now, Ellen Ratner is with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., with our update for the day on what's happening in the belly of the beast. Hey, Ellen.
Hi. The belly of the beast has a U.S. economy slowing, actually, in the second quarter. As you know, it was very good during the first quarter at 5.6%, but it went to 2.5%. So it basically went in half. And so that is going to be interesting to see what happens, of course, in terms of whether this becomes a trend that the Bush people were definitely not crowing about that this morning.
Yeah, my guess is, and everything I've been reading, and particularly if you look at what's going on with housing right now, prices of houses all across the country are starting to fall. Housing inventory is increasing. What I've been saying for the last year, actually the last 2 years, is that most of the so-called economic recovery of the Bush administration has actually been a debt-driven economy. Americans are not making more money. Average wage earners are making about 5% less right now in inflation-adjusted dollars than they were when Bush came into office. So it hasn't been a good economy for anybody except the very wealthy in the United States. And so what's been happening is the middle class have been, because the values of their homes have been going up, because interest rates have been so low, the values of their homes are going up, so they're refinancing and they're spending that money, that debt money, and that's
stimulating
the economy.
Now prices of homes have gone down in the last 3 months.
That's right, and interest rates have gone up, and so they don't have access to be able to borrow against their home any longer, and so that source of borrowed money as stimulus for the economy is going away, and if it goes away a whole bunch more, it could drop us into a tailspin, in my opinion.
For sure. The other interesting thing that happened today is that President and Prime Minister Blair had a meeting at the White House. Blair basically and Bush have called for now a multinational force in Lebanon. Condoleezza Rice said she is going back to the area, and she is she's essentially going to be in Israel tomorrow night. She's going to meet the Prime Minister, Olmert, and then she would not say whether she's actually going to be going on to Beirut or not. But she is going back there ASAP, and I think that was decided at the Blair meeting.
Now, when Bush said in the famous Yo Blair speech, you know, when he talking through a mouthful of bread, when he told Tony Blair that all that had to happen to resolve this whole problem in the Middle East,
they have to stop that. Right.
Well, actually, yeah, expletive deleted. But what he said was that all he had, somebody, he wanted Kofi Annan to get on the phone with Assad in Syria and tell Syria to tell Hezbollah to stop this stuff, right? And that says to me that Bush had no idea about what's going on. I mean, if he, you know, he thinks that Syria can just make a phone call and it'll all stop.
Exactly.
I mean, are you seeing in this now call for multinational activity and in what Bush is saying today any evidence that George Bush gets it, or is he just doing what his State Department's telling him to do?
I think he's very much doing what his State Department is telling him to do, and you know, a lot of people feel that Condoleezza Rice just does not have it.
Oh, interesting.
That she's very good at coming up with, you know, words. And she always looks forceful, but she doesn't. I mean, what I hear from people in the State Department is, you know, she's no Jim Baker.
She's not competent as a diplomat, in other words.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
Because she doesn't know really how to play. I mean, what made James Baker a good Secretary of State, whether you liked his policies or not, is he was able to get people to the table, he knew how to play poker, and he played it.
Yeah, well, and the same was true of Henry Kissinger.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, who I consider a war criminal, but nonetheless, he was a very skillful guy.
Right. But, you know, every one of those people engaged Syria.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, historically, you know, we've always talked to our enemies. I mean, the Soviet Union was our biggest enemy. They had 7,000 nuclear weapons pointed at us. So what did we do? We installed a hotline to them so that we could talk. I mean, you talk to your enemies or to the people that you see as potential adversaries. I'm just, you know, it just boggles my mind that Bush's policy is that we're not going to talk to people that we may have conflict with. I don't get it.
One last thing. It looks like the House is, they were going to begin its August break today, but now it looks like they're going through a Saturday session, and they're trying to come up with some what they call priority bills, particularly to look at pensions and estate taxes and minimum wage. because Nancy Pelosi this morning said that she wants, they are really trying to make that minimum wage thing go as far as possible.
Yeah, and the Republicans are going to try and poison pill it.
And do you believe that Bush is having a photo op with the 10 top contenders for American Idol? Give me a break.
Yeah, well, that's what we have. We have the entertainment president. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Good talking with you. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program. We'll be back with your calls and more right after this.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Remember, democracy starts with you. Tag your ears.
Indeed. Welcome back, my friends. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-8466, toll-free all across the United States. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our message board where you, too, can blog or message or whatever you want to call it, post messages, and or our live chat room where you can interact with folks from all over the country. And let's see here. Jeff in Sacramento, California wants to disagree with me. So, Jeff, you go to the front of the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. What's on your mind, Jeff?
Well, the statement about an educated populace is true, but that's why we have education provided for free for the grade 1 through 9 or even to high school so that the populace will be educated in basic reading, writing, arithmetic, and be able to at least carry on an educated conversation. It doesn't mean that they are entitled to high or college education so that they can compete against other people.
Why should not a kid whose dad is a mill worker have the same ability to grow up to be a physician as a kid whose dad is a stockbroker who makes $1 million a year?
Or the one that has the ability from the standpoint of a mill worker can probably get grants, and if he shows
not
the
true.
Ability, he can.
Not
but
true. There's a very, you know, everybody says, oh, well, all you have to do is get a scholarship. You wouldn't believe the competition for scholarships.
Oh, I believe it. My kid had to do it. But see, the thing is, nobody is entitled to compete equally. That's just not right. I mean,
no, this has nothing to do with competition, Jeff. This has to do with whether or not we want to have Americans have the ability, regardless of the circumstances of their birth, to have the kind of education that will allow them to go as far in life as they choose to. And I'll give you right up front, there's going to be a lot of Americans who are going to say, you know, I don't want a higher education. I'd like to work at Oldsmobile and make cars all my life. Or, you know, I'd like to be a salesman or something. You know, some people don't have a calling that requires a college education. That's a fine and wonderful thing. I'm all in favor of that. We need car mechanics and we need people picking up the garbage and all that kind of thing. And those people should have decent wages as well, by the way, which is a whole different argument. But for those people who want to get into professions or industries that require a college education, I don't understand. Actually, I do understand. It's the conservative worldview, which says that we should have classes and orders in society.
Why
it should be that only those people whose parents are wealthy or who are willing to become essentially indentured slaves have access to that kind of education.
Yeah, but in the past, many decades, the Democrats have always used this phrase about education is the great equalizer, and what they have
it
done,
is
what they have done is created a situation where a college degree does not mean anything anymore. I mean, look in California.
No, what has
everybody to pass the exam, and if they can't pass the exam, you don't get a diploma, and yet they're trying to make it so that everybody get a diploma. What good is a diploma now? Okay, this is where I have...
Well, that's a whole completely different issue, Jeff, from
no,
whether or not people should
same.
Be paying for higher education.
It's the same for college. There's been all these people that get through college on barely being able to make it academically, and at the end they all get a diploma. And with that diploma, you can...
And if they come from a rich family, like George W. Bush, they can go through, and he goes around bragging about the fact that he almost flunked out of college because he came from a rich family. If his dad worked in a tool and die shop all his life, like my dad did, he would not have been able to have that education and have those C grades.
There's always going to be those kind of people, Tom. But see, I don't want to as a middle class.
Jeff, I'm sorry. The poor you're always going to have with you argument doesn't cut it for me. We're talking about the future of democracy in America. If we're going to have democracy, a functional democracy, we have to have an educated educated populace.
Yes, true, but not everybody to the college.
And if America's potential is going to be realized, Jeff, if the United States, here we are in this new competitive world that the world is flat, right? Thomas Friedman and all these maniacs who want to say, yes, we should all compete against everybody in India and China and everybody on an absolutely level playing field. Then it becomes even more critical that all that potential that's out there in America among kids who do not come from wealthy families, that potential be realized.
But
and conservatives don't want that potential to be realized simply because those kids didn't come from wealthy families.
No, but that has nothing to do with our
Has everything to do with it, Jeff. That's what we're talking about.
No, the competition we have with India is not wealth or degree. It's just the fact that they're cheaper in labor. The competition that we have in the United States is that you have everybody with a phony degree competing and being able to. Then, hello?
Yeah, I'm giving you a little more rope here because you're starting to get into the realm of incoherence, Jeff.
No. Well, see, here's what my problem is. I save for my kids' education, okay? Now, I'm not going to be willing to pay for my kids' education so he could get ahead and also pay taxes so that somebody else's kid could go to college and get a degree. Now, if the
So what if you just only had to pay the taxes so that your kid and everybody else's kid who had the potential and ability and desire to go to college and succeed in college could do so, and you didn't have to pay for your child to go to college out of your own pocket? Wouldn't that be a better world?
No,
we'd be spreading the risk around. We'd be spreading the cost around. We would all be paying less.
Okay, and if everybody has a degree and...
No, I'm not suggesting everybody should have a degree.
No, but see, this is the premise that you're going by.
No, it's not.
Even everybody at college education...
My premise is real simple, Jeff, that people who want to go to college, who want to go into professions that require a college education, and who have the intellectual capacity to do that, who have the ability to do that by, the mind ability to do that, should not be limited from doing that because their parents aren't rich. And that's the world that the conservatives are increasingly pushing us into. It started with Ronald Reagan flipping... it didn't start with him. He was the last to just, come right out and say it. Okay, that's it. No more free University of California.
That would be great, Tom, except that that's not how the real world goes.
How the real world went for most of the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, Jeff. It really did. That's how my mother went to Michigan State University, land-grant college. She did not come from a wealthy family. She had essentially a free education. She had to pay for the dorm. But, it was because it was a land-grant college. My father went to college on the GI Bill. We don't have those kinds of programs available anymore for the children of the middle class. And the Bush administration is slashing the few that we have. And so now we have, as I said, the Bush Department of Education, the Bush administration's Department of Education, 39% of all students graduate with unmanageable levels of debt. An unmanageable level of debt means that they cannot pay that debt off with the kind of job that they can get
for a while myself.
Yeah.
But see, I'm willing to do it for my kids' education.
Because you were wealthy enough to do it, Jeff.
I am not wealthy. I'm lower middle class. But I save. I don't buy my second, third, fourth, fifth television. I save.
Well, God bless you, Jeff. I honor that. But I don't think that you should have had to do that.
But why do... if you let everybody have a chance to go to college because they want to, do you think that most of the people that are there are going to be for education? They're going to be there to get a... time to there's no draft, so you can't get a deferment, but at least they'll go there and get free money.
I'm not suggesting, Jeff, that we should give college educations to people who sit in class and do nothing. If you can't succeed, if you flunk out, sorry, that's it.
That's what's happening because you give them phony degrees.
Okay. I'll agree with you, Jeff, that I'm opposed to phony degrees. I think we've kind of run this conversation to the point where it's starting to go around in circles. But I appreciate your call and hope you call again. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, you want to weigh in on this issue? Will? No Will. Okay. We'll put Will on hold and let's see here. Carolyn in Tempe, Arizona. Hey, Carolyn, what's up?
Yes, hi, Tom. I just watched a video presentation last night by a woman who has a master's in education. That's her field. And she told a very troubling story about our educational system and what she has learned about it. I guess it started when Child came home and told his mom about what a test was like that they had given him. And she thought, well, that sounds very, very strange. And she went to the school and asked, she didn't believe it, so she went to the school and asked to see the test. And they said, no, you can't. You know, it's a confidential test. She said, no, wait a minute. You don't understand. I'm the parent. Yes, I can. I can see what test you've given myself.
What was the point, Carol?
Yeah, the bottom line was that what she found out when she went looking was they switched over our education system to where it used to be 12 years you graduated, and now it's goal-oriented, and it's until you produce the results that they're looking for, which maybe sounds okay, but when she looked into it, she demanded to see the goals. They showed her goals. She said, this is strange stuff. Who came up with this? And they said, we did locally. But when she said, wait a minute, you know, you're saying there was nothing in the room and you just came up with this? And anyway, she found out.
Carolyn, are you suggesting that the Republicans are trying to control our children? Is that the bottom line here?
Well, basically, these are federal mandates that have come down.
Yeah, this is the whole No Child Left Behind thing. It's these guys who think that the only measurement of success in school is whether somebody can regurgitate something that they've memorized. And memorization is one important skill, but it's only one. Critical thinking, frankly, in my opinion, is a more important skill. And the teaching to the test destroys critical thinking. Critical thinking is now absent from our schools. Most kids graduate from high school not even knowing what critical thinking is. And the ability to have a discussion, you know, Socratic method teaching is gone. I mean, it's just the entire, you're right, our school systems have changed dramatically. It's the reason why Jim Jeffords left the Republican Party, because education had been his lifelong passion and issue as a United States Senator. And he said, that's it, I'm out of here. And because Bush is just trying to destroy our schools. 45 minutes past the hour. I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
Battle flag in the bassinet, oil and blood on the bayonet, crowded downtown, hit the floor, what are we fighting for?
Indeed, welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back to our program. 1-866-440-8466, our telephone number. Brian in Eureka, California, you're live and on the air. Brian, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I just had to respond to the gentleman from the Cato Institute in their position. You know, the idea that too many people go into college without graduating with a mountain of debt, if it's made available to too many, let's not say all, because as you mentioned, all wouldn't go. It's the same argument they make against health care for all. You know, that too many would want to go out and have a surgery. Well, as being a nurse for 20 years, I can tell you nobody wants to go out and just have a surgery willy-nilly, except a very small number of patients who are mentally ill, okay? So that idea just goes out the window. And the only thing that having systems that, you know, both of these systems, be it education or health care, systems now, they only insure profits for HMOs or, you know, prestigious universities, and basically low and middle class are, you know, once again kind of left out of the loop. I don't even have children, but I'll tell you, I would gladly have a tax increase if it increased the educational level of our populace, if it increased access to health care for our populace. I'd be all for it.
Yeah, we have a nursing shortage, for example, in the United States.
Sure.
And it is so difficult to get into nursing colleges now, and then once you do, it costs a fortune. And so what's the solution for the conservatives are suggesting? Well, let's start importing nurses from India. You know, they'll work for less. And so they're doing that, and the problem then is, over in India, now they have a nursing shortage.
And it's like, wait a minute. And the other thing he talked about as far as, and they always trot this out, well, if you don't have competition, you have stagnation. Well, you know how you can fight that is with proper standards and policies.
Yeah.
And
if you
oversight schools and say, no, we're not going to let some deadhead sit in class and doof off for 4, 6, 8 years.
No, nobody's suggesting that. Yeah. Well said, Brian. Well said.
Thank you
very much for the call. I appreciate it. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Will, let's try it again.
Yes, I'm sorry. My salt dropped you, Tom.
No problem.
Tom, I went through the, by the way, I'm glad you confronted that, John. I'm glad you pointed out his folly about public education and the need for all of us to have access to free education. I'm a firm believer in that, Tom. I believe our public schools have failed miserably in this country. I'm for the voucher system, Tom.
You're talking about not college. You're talking about high school and junior
no,
high school.
No, everything. No, college,
just
everything.
The whole shooting match, a voucher
system.
The
whole shooting match, Tom. And exactly.
Why?
I'll tell you why. I believe in merit. If a poor ghetto kid has the grades, or if a middle class kid has the grades, or if a rich kid, if they carry a B average, they should get a scholarship.
Yeah, well, here's how voucher systems work. First of all, if the people who are advancing voucher systems really believed in good quality free education for everybody, they'd simply say, you can go to any school you want and we'll pay the bill. But what they do with the vouchers is the average cost for education, for secondary education in the United States, for junior high school, middle school, whatever you call, in the United States is around $5,600, as I recall. And so what they do is they say, well, we'll give you a voucher for $3,000. And what that means is that if I'm sending my kid to a private school, it's costing me $15,000 a year. I just got a $3,000 subsidy from the government. But if I'm sending my kid to a public school and I don't have the means to send them to a private school, that $3,000 voucher does me no good whatsoever. Voucher systems are set up as a welfare system for the upper middle class and the wealthy in the United States to basically buy their votes, and as a way of further destroying public education. Principally by people who are hell-bent for leather to destroy the unions that are associated with public education in the United States.
Well, Tom, am I understanding you? So you're saying I misunderstood that, then. That's not a good deal.
No, it's not. There are no voucher programs out there that are not really basically Republican scams.
Tom, you spent time in Germany, right?
Yeah, I lived there for a year.
Okay, now, I went through a school system for 3.5 years. In the fourth grade, it was mandatory I take Russian, and German was elective. We went to school 5.5 days, Tom. Monday through Friday, we had to be there at 8, got out at 4, and we had to go in on Saturday.
What country is this?
Hungary.
In Hungary, okay.
Yeah, I was born there.
Yep.
I was born there, and we came over during the revolution. We came over to this country in 1957,
mm-hmm.
And they were strict, Tom.
Yeah, well, what's your point here, Will?
The thing is that education is paramount to our children, and our public education is failing our children. We cannot even compete with the world.
No, and I got to say, Will, I agree with you. And the reason why it's failing is because of the Bush administration policies. They're trying to destroy education. George in Coos Bay, Oregon. Hey, George, we just have about a half a minute left before we've got to wrap up this hour. What's on your mind?
Hi, real quickly. On Wednesday, NPR had a report that Margaret Spelling, Secretary of Education, purposely withheld a report until Friday afternoon. She held on to it for 2 weeks because it said that if you go to public schools or private schools, you pretty much get the same results. So that did not exactly jive.
Right, and the third part, the other shoe that dropped, was if you go to a Christian school, you get less results. The kids who were the graduates of the Christian schools were the ones who had the worst test results.
Well, sure, they're
and this was a Department of Education study. Yeah, you're right, George.
Their science text is the Bible.
There you go. And in fact, they held that study back to release it during, on the Friday, on the tail end of Friday, also as, waiting until there were huge headlines about war and things like that. So, yeah, good point. By the way, just a reminder, Monday night, I'll be the MC of a fundraiser for Congressman Jim McDermott with former President Bill Clinton in Seattle. If you want to show up, want more information about that, or would just like to help out Congressman Jim McDermott, McDermott for Congress, MC Dermott, DERMOTTFOR, Congress.com is the website. Check it out. It's 57 minutes past the hour. We'll be back right after the news at the top of the hour.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back. Is the United States headed for a disaster? Is the economy about to crash? Is 1929 all over again? Is it going to be urban warfare? Or is it going to be a soft landing? How are things going to go? What does the future hold? George Ure runs the website urbansurvival.com, and really a fascinating website. This is one that George didn't come to us. We went to him very often. Most of our guests, you know, you get press releases from groups in the, you know, the Cato Institute or whatever. Hey, we've got an idea here. Not the case here. We've been reading his website for some time and thought, this guy's got something to say. George, welcome to the program.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Tom. How are you today?
Just fine, George. Urbansurvival.com, the website. You say you have a unique perspective on today's news and economic outlook because it's all happened before. What do you mean?
Well, it really has. When we look back at the depression that occurred in the 1930s, what we see are some really remarkable ways that it parallels today's experience. One can look at the tremendous amount of money that was lost when the tech stock bubble burst, starting in about the spring of 2000. And the bursting of the market has really continued pretty much unabated from there till maybe October of 2002. And now we're in this long wave economic bounce, if you will, which was very similar, looks very similar chart-wise to what was going on in America from about 33 through late 36, early 37. Unfortunately, a couple of other things happened in that period of time in our history. We had huge government spending breakout in the Depression, and we can see a parallel.
We're having that right now with the government spending. I mean, Bush has increased the government larger and faster than any president in the history of the United States, particularly with the Iraq adventure.
Oh, absolutely. And I would argue that, you know, what one could postulate, whether it's true or not, it sure is convenient that the war on terror came along when it did, because otherwise millions of Americans would realize, oh my gosh, we're in trouble with our life savings and retirement if we slip into a depression.
Yeah. There's one big difference between 1929 and today with regard to the stock market, George Ure, and that is that back in 1929, most of the people in the stock market were able to get in and get out really rapidly. And, in fact, a lot of them did on a regular basis. And whereas today, a good chunk of the stock market, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I've seen them before, but we're talking well over half of investors in the stock market are large institutional investors, pension funds, union pension funds, government pension funds, these kinds of large institutional investors who don't turn on a dime, who don't go in and out of markets, who are going to be there 5-10 years. They're playing the game for the long term. Plus, we've got a large number of people with 401ks doing the same thing. They're not playing the market like they were in the 20s. And some suggest that that's such a stabilizing influence that a market crash of the proportions of 1929 just isn't possible now. What's your take on that?
Well, there's a couple of things to say. First of all, yes, it's true that the 401k guys are probably contributing to market stability. However, if you look at the experience of 1987, when we had our mini crash then, or more recently when we had the Asia contagion go around in the late 1990s, we saw some decline in how the market performed in that period.
Right, but those weren't economy destroying, at least not in the United States.
Right. Those were bumps along the way. What we're looking at now potentially is a complete collapse of paper assets. And that's really the difficult thing to wrap your head around. You know, when the U.S. dollar was set up, if you will, by the Federal Reserve in 1913, the dollar today is down to about 4.9 cents worth of purchasing power. In other words, we've got 1/20th of the purchasing power in a $1 bill today that we had in 1913. At some point, as we continue dropping the purchasing power of the dollar, paper assets will drop commensurately, in my view.
paper assets being stocks, being
stocks,
cash?
Yeah, stocks, bonds, cash.
But stocks and bonds are a whole different animal. But stocks represent the equity, the wealth, the value of a real business, of a real tangible thing. So even though they are a, you know, it's a, you, when you trade stock, you're trading a piece of paper. It's a piece of paper that represents something. The U.S. dollar, on the other hand, represents the full faith and credit of the United States government, but it's no longer backed by gold. It's really backed by the world's belief that we're not going to be idiots with our dollar. And I would argue that the Bush administration in particular, but going all the way back to Nixon, that we are being idiots with our dollar.
Oh, there's no question about that. And what ends up happening, Tom, is we have to pay other people more and more money to take on our debt instruments that are keeping the current spending spree alive. And so when you look at paper assets, first of all, what do those assets really represent? You know, we're in a country now where one job out of six is really producing something. The other five jobs are in service industries.
Are just moving things around.
Exactly. And so when you look at the valuation of a company, which a share of stock represents, really those companies are not returning purchasing power to the investor in that paper. Really where the gains have been, and by the way, look at companies like Microsoft, which didn't pay a dividend for years and years and years, and now is just slowly moving into that area. Look at where people are making their gains in the market. They're not coming from real returns being handed back out in terms of dividends. They're coming along in stock price appreciation and a soaring P.E. ratio.
Yeah, we're talking with George Uhr, who is the operator of UrbanSurvival.com, the website UrbanSurvival.com. George, there's two classic crash scenarios. One is the deflationary crash scenario, where dollars, where credit money becomes less and less available and thus becomes much more and more valuable. And there are some who suggest that as the interest rates go up in the United States, housing prices start to fall, that's going to suck liquidity out of the market, and we could, and that could throw us into a depressionary or deflationary spiral, sort of like the Great Depression. The other is the inflationary spiral that Germany experienced after World War One. They had these huge reparations that they had to pay as a consequence of the Treaty of Versailles, and that were denominated in marks. You know, they had to pay back France and all these other countries in marks, and so they said, okay, cool, we'll just run the printing presses all day long and make the mark worth less. They ultimately made it worth less. And so it took literally a bushel basket full of Deutschmarks to buy a loaf of bread. And there are some who suggest that the Bush administration in particular, although they actually suggest that the Reagan administration really began this process with, you know, running us up into massive debt, it has been trying to depreciate the value of our dollar so that we can pay off the debt that in particular the Reagan and Bush administrations have run up. Which of those two scenarios makes the most sense to you, or is it something else altogether?
I think what we're going to see, Tom, will be actually a blend of the two.
Stagflation thing, then, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks like stagflation, but it's not really. The inflation that's going on right now is in those core things that the government doesn't like to talk about. They keep talking about inflation, less food and energy. And you can't live without food, and you can't live without energy. So it's really a bogus tweak the number kind of deal, because what they're trying to do is manage inflation expectations. Now, in the short term, I think we'll get up to the point where we'll see 6.5% inflation on a trailing six-month basis, and you can get that by simply adding up the CPI numbers when they come out. And then later on, once we hit that that straw that breaks the camel's back in the housing market, and that's starting to fall apart as we speak, what'll happen then is housing prices and everything else will begin really coming down,
and then you're going to have a whole lot of people caught with terrible debt,
and thanks to the administration, bankruptcy is no longer the convenient way out that it once was.
Right.
So what they're really doing is trapping a lot of people in this unwinnable situation where you're likely to end up If you follow the refinance your house, you know, and pull equity out and
right.
buy gasoline, food, whatever you need to live. And by the way, we saw that in the personal savings rate figures that were out this morning in the GDP. People are continuing to have to take money out of the bank to make ends meet.
So we're still in negative savings.
Negative savings rate continues. Absolutely.
Right. People are borrowing from their homes. I've been arguing that to the extent that there is any recovery in the economy since Bush became president, that it has been a phony one because it's been people borrowing money against the phony appreciated value of their house and spending that money and stimulating the economy. George, can you stick around over the break?
Sure.
Because the next set of questions I'd like to ask you is, what's the average person to do about this?
Good question.
Your website's urbansurvival.com. How do we survive? We're talking with George Ur. He runs urbansurvival.com. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 16 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm not ready to be nice. I'm not ready to back down. Too many sailors don't have time to go round and round and round. It's too late to make it right. Probably wouldn't if I could. Cause I'm mad as hell. Can't bring myself to do what it is.
And welcome back. Helping you win the water cooler wars, Tom Hartman here with you. We have George Ur on the line. You're on the line. U-R-E is how it's spelled. He's the operator of the website urbansurvival.com.
When I'm not doing my real job, which is heading up sales at emachineshop.com.
Okay, cool. We'll give a plug to that, too, emachineshop.com.
Yeah.
George, first of all, I'm curious what your take is on what's happening right now. The stock market today is up 115 points. There's a piece in the Wall Street Journal that says that in all probability the market's going to go up because they're not expecting Bernanke to raise interest rates in the next Fed round. Gold, on the other hand, is up to 635 today. It was down around the low 600s earlier in the week, last week. There are some people who are predicting gold's going to go to 2,000. Some are predicting it's going to drop back down to 300-400. Some people are saying the market's going to go to 15,000. Others saying it's going to go to 5. I mean, what's a person to do?
Well, the first thing you have to do is detach yourself from the numbers. You can't believe any of the numbers out there. First of all, the numbers that are reported in terms of cost of living and all these other things that Wall Street looks very carefully at, those are all delicately massaged and have no correlation at all to most people's actual experience. Okay, that's point one. Get detached from the numbers. Secondly, try to come up with what I call the bulletproof strategy. Build yourself a position in life where you can benefit about equally from inflation and deflation. And it's kind of hard to do, and it's almost impossible to do it in a big city. But if you try moving out of the big city, walk out on your high-paying, perhaps high-paying, but living life on the freeway kind of a job, what my wife and I did was left six figures in L.A. and headed out to the middle of nowhere in Texas, and we're actually quite happy out here. We've got, deer in the front yard and vegetables in the vegetable patch, and that's a great starting point.
This is like my wife's grandmother who had a 100-acre farm in Michigan and basically didn't notice the Great Depression.
Of course not, because if you have food, we can run goats, a couple of head of cattle, and so forth, as well as all the vegetables.
Yeah, but George, that's really not an option for the vast majority of our listeners. Is there any sort of job strategy or investment strategy,
or
for that matter, I mean, a lot of people don't even have money to invest. They're massively in debt. A manage your debt strategy that people should pursue.
Well, the simple manage your debt strategy is don't go in debt. Try to not get hypnotized by those flashy ads that want you to lease a car and buy the new big screen TV and so forth.
What about somebody who has a home mortgage?
Oh, home mortgage. Get the lowest rate you can and use a mortgage accelerator and get that thing down. Or alternatively, if you're in a real expensive house, consider downsizing.
Yeah. So basically what you're saying is reduce your debt as quickly as possible.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The bottom line.
And then
now there are some, however, who suggest that in an inflationary environment, you want to be as deeply in debt as possible because you'll be paying off your debt with dollars that are worth less.
But if you're wrong because of the bankruptcy laws, you're in a pickle.
Yeah.
So if you really want to bet on inflation, one can argue that in the inflationary scenario, you want to hold gold and rent. And then take your appreciation on something that's small and portable and is harder to take away from you than somebody coming around and saying, oh, you're one payment behind, there goes your house.
Yeah. Well, do you think gold is going to go up?
Personally, yeah. Yeah. I do.
Because the dollar is going down in value or for other reasons?
Exactly. Any kind of a currency hedge at this point really makes sense. There are some banks where you can deposit U.S. dollars and set them into a foreign currency denominated account.
Right. Everbank is the main one on the internet, I think, that allows you to do that.
Right, right. Yeah. And even, you know, putting money in a Canadian bank, you notice that Canada, being a resource-based economy more so than we are, the resources are going to be critical going forward. Those countries with oil, timber, arable land, those kinds of things.
Right. Should people who have money in a 401k retirement fund that's in the stock market be bailing out of the market? I mean, what should they do?
I don't offer financial advice per se. I simply am an observer of the times. However, I have zero money in the stock market. I stopped playing options about 2 years ago and said, enough. The market is not performing rationally. There is so much program trading right now. It's like trying to make money playing poker against two video poker machines.
Interesting. So where should somebody invest their 401k or whatever, you know, or their retirement funds?
I'm a great fan of
buy gold stocks?
Not even the stocks. Regular physical gold, to me, makes a lot more sense. Because again, gold stocks, they're a paper asset, Tom. And, yeah, so far the market's been really, you know, very robust and reliable, and there's all the backups in the world and so forth. But, again, you're dealing with pieces of paper.
Well, there's like the Canadian Foreign Exchange, CFE, I think, is their thing. It's they own gold.
Yeah.
You buy their stock, you're buying gold through them.
But then you still have to exchange paper for something at some point.
I see. So you're saying actually get the stuff. Interesting. Okay,
yep.
George Ure, he's with UrbanSurvival.com. We've just scratched the surface. You can check it all out at his website. George, great talking with you today.
Tom, thank you for having me on.
Sure. Thanks for coming on the program. I really appreciate it. 27 minutes past the hour, the Tom Hartman Radio Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
A song will lift as the mainsail ships and the boat drifts unto the shoreline. And the sun will respect every face on the deck the hour that the ships come in. And the sands will roll out a carpet of gold for your weary toes to be a-touching. And the ship's wise men will remind you once again that the whole wide world is watching.
And welcome back. Exposing the con and conservative. Tom Hartman here with you, 34 minutes past the hour. It's, how to frame this? I think the essential core of in today's entire program has been that there is a war on the middle class. There is an ongoing war against the middle class in the United States, and it's really not a new war. This is something that really started, arguably thousands of years ago. Historically, there have been three forms of government, what Jefferson referred to as the three great tyrannies, ruled by warlords. George Bush is trying to reinvent himself as a warlord. Warlord kings use fear and violence as a way of maintaining power. And they would say, hey, you know, those guys down the street, they're going to get us. That, therefore, you need to put me in charge. And therefore, you need to help build my castle bigger and bigger. And so you see all these castles all over Europe, for example. And the reason why the people would build the castle is because they figured, hey, those guys, that you know, in the next kingdom over, they're going to come get us someday. And we can all go hide in the king's castle if the day ever comes. And that was the rationale that the kings used. And what was going on behind the scenes was that the kings had deals with each other. Where they said, you know, yeah, we're, you know, every couple of years we'll have a little bit of a war and we'll, a few people will kill each other off. And what it'll do is it'll keep us in power. It'll keep the game going. James Madison pointed out that war is the most dangerous of all things to the United States, to the American democracy. Because war increases the power of the presidency. And Madison said, you know, this is something that has to be very, we must be very careful about. And it's why when he, you know, he's referred to as the father of the Constitution, why when he supervised the writing of the American Constitution, they made sure that the power to make and wage war rested solely with Congress, with the House of Representatives and the Senate, that those bodies that are most answerable to we the people. And the power of the purse strings is exclusively there. All spending originates in the House of Representatives, the only body that's elected every 2 years, every single member. So, number one, you've got warlord kings. George Bush reinventing himself as a warlord king. This is part of the war on the middle class. Why? Because in order to be a warlord king, you can't have a strong middle class. You have a strong middle class, you have what happened in the 60s and the 70s, the reaction of the Vietnam War. You have a middle class that stands up and says, no, we're not going to play your war games. We're not going to give you that kind of power, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Nixon. We're not going to do it. We're not going to march off into your war. But if you wipe out that middle class, if you can get enough people who are desperate enough for money, then you have a situation where you can have basically a mercenary army. As warlord kings always did. Thomas Jefferson once said, I'm paraphrasing from memory, but I think it's pretty close. He said, I hope I shall never see the day when young Americans will be willing to be fired at for a sixpence. This was part of his argument when he was corresponding with James Madison when he was living in France about that led to the Second Amendment, that we should not have standing armies during time of war. That every able-bodied man, was his definition back then, 17 to 47 years of age, should be a member of a local militia. And the local militia should be under local control. And they could only be federalized if the nation was invaded. Now, he didn't quite get his way, and you know the compromise that ended up was the Second Amendment, but you know he got started on it. So, number one, warlord kings. George W. Bush reinventing himself as a warlord king, and you can't, as I said, you can't have a middle class if you're going to be a successful warlord, because the middle class will say, no, we don't want to do that. This is why when you go back and you look and you say, hey, you know, no two democracies have ever attacked each other. Until, I guess, recently here, Israel attacking the democracy of Lebanon, you could argue. But, you know, then they would argue, no, we're not attacking Lebanon, we're attacking Hezbollah, but I don't want to get into that whole argument. I mean, we've already talked that thing to death over the last week or two. But the point is that by and large, democracies don't attack each other. Why? Because in democracies, people will not vote to send their children to war. They will defensively. Democracies will defend themselves, but two democracies? No, just by and large doesn't happen. And that little slice of reality has been the thing that the neocons have been using to promote this idea of, oh, if we can just install a democracy in the Middle East, then everything will be fine. We'll just knock over Saddam Hussein, we'll install a democratic government, and everything will be fine because democracies don't go to war with each other. That's the animating belief behind the whole neocon agenda. Go back and read Francis Fukuyama, for example, one of the great neocon thinkers. And he talks about that. I quote some of this stuff in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? The problem is that a democracy, a functional democracy, a truly functional democracy, requires an educated middle class. And laissez-faire economics with, quote, free trade in a, quote, flat world does not produce a middle class. It produces a ruling class, a very thinly layered ruling upper class, and a whole bunch of people who are basically poor and, the working poor. It takes us back to the world of Charles Dickens.
Please, Mr. Scrooge, may I have a lump of coal? My fingers are cold.
No, you may not. That'll cost me an extra pence. I'm not going to do that. No.
May I have some money, please, for my son, Tiny Tim? He has a medical condition.
No, what health care? Are you kidding? No.
And so on. I mean, that's the world that the conservatives want to take us back to. And they're usually, particularly you read where they're talking to themselves, so you read in the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, or you go back and read Russell Kirk's book, The Conservative Mind, back in 1953, you read the writings of some of the early conservatives, Sir Edmund Burke, they're pretty honest about it. The reason that they think that that's the best kind of world is because it's a stable society. There aren't the upheavals of, for example, the 60s. You don't have uppity folks saying, hey, women want rights, and African Americans want rights, and students don't want, they want a decent education and at a reasonable price, and they don't, or free education. Holy cow! Ronald Reagan did away with that in California in a hurry. And by the way, no, we don't want war. So number one, the first of the three tyrannies, warlord kings. George Bush reinventing himself as one. The second classic type of tyranny, according to Thomas Jefferson, was theocracies. Government rule by those who say that they have the right to rule because God told them to, or God gave them the authority. And again, we see the Bush administration reinventing itself as a theocracy, the second of the three most deadly tyrannies against democracy that Jefferson identified and that the founders were aware of. This is why Jefferson, in his letter to Madison, he said we shall put an absolute wall of separation between church and state. Now, Jefferson was concerned that If churchmen, to use his phrase, got governmental power, they would use that governmental power to enrich themselves and to make decisions for the state based on theology. Like, wouldn't it be nice if Jesus came back? Let's go have a war in the Middle East because it's going to bring about the rapture. That kind of thing would happen. That was Jefferson's big fear. Madison agreed with Jefferson that there should be a separation of church and state, but he didn't think America would be so stupid that they would let anybody ever rule America, anybody ever be an elected official who held those kinds of beliefs. Madison, instead, was afraid that if we started subsidizing churches, that if there was a mingling of church and state, that it would corrupt religion. And Madison was a fairly religious guy, whereas Jefferson was a bit more of an agnostic. Jefferson was a deist and Madison was a Christian. And Madison was, afraid that if government started giving money to churches, that the churches would get corrupted. And that's why his first veto as president, James Madison, the 1, 2, 3, 4th president of the United States, his first veto was to veto a bill that appropriated money, and it was passed by the House and Senate, to give money to a church in Washington, D.C. to care for the poor in Washington, D.C. And he vetoed it. He said, no, we're not going to give money to churches because it will corrupt the churches. The churches will then begin to engage in the game of politics, and they will depart from their true mission, which is, to save souls and do good in the world or whatever it may be. And now we're seeing in this administration both the fears of Jefferson and of Madison being realized. And both of these guys were convinced that the other was being, too hysterical. And then the third historic tyranny, the tyranny of rule by the rich. It was called feudalism. A highly stratified class society where only the rich can send their children to school. Only the rich can hold particular positions. And you have a large population of basically insecure and poor people. And how do you maintain insecurity among the population? Don't offer them universal health care. Don't offer them universal education. Call those things, that's socialism. You don't want that. Well, yeah, I would like that. I don't care what you call it.
No. You don't want that. That's socialism.
And if you can keep people afraid enough that the next big illness might wipe them out, or afraid enough that they of losing their job, then they will work, and they'll work for pennies. And Walmart can be very profitable. And all these other corporations, and their stock can go up, and the people who own the stock, who make the money from the dividends, can have marvelous, marvelous returns on investment. And this is the war that's being waged against the middle class today, and you can see it right on the front page of today's New York Times. 45 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Indeed, that's how the light gets in. Welcome back, my friends. 9.5 minutes before the hour, and if you have a chance to see that new movie, I'm Your Man, Leonard Cohen movie, it is awesome. Welcome back to the program. Our number 1-866-440-8466. And where I wanted to go with this thing, I want to wrap the fine point I want to put on this, talking about how not only is the Bush administration, not only are the Republicans and the conservative Democrats, by the way, let's just say not only are the conservatives not interested in there being a healthy middle class in the United States. It's not that there's benign neglect. It's not that they've made some mistakes. It's not that at all. No, they don't want there to be a strong middle class in the United States, because a strong middle class will stand up to power and will demand democracy. This is the fundamental mistake. I started to talk about it earlier in the last segment. I mentioned this. The fundamental mistake that was made in the Middle East was the assumption that democracy is elections. Elections are a symptom of democracy. They are not democracy. Democracy is something that grows out of a middle class. And to the extent that America is a democratic nation, we have been the most democratic during those periods of time when our middle class has been the strongest. And we have been the least democratic during those times when our middle class has been the most destroyed. And it is absolutely true of every country all around the world. And that's why so many Western European countries are going to systems where you can have a free college education all the way up to a PhD if you're able to do it. You can have a free apprenticeship all the way up to master mechanic or master, you know, whatever it may be, if you're inclined and if you have the ability to do it. You have free health care, and it is not a nanny state, to paraphrase the conservatives. It is the social infrastructure that is necessary for a functioning democracy. And the reason why Iraq is, in all probability, going to end up being an Islamic republic that is not going to be, in all probability, the kind of country that we would hope for or we would have envisioned, is because the first thing the Bushes did when they went in is they destroyed the middle class. When Paul Bremer went in, when L. Paul Bremer went in, he kicked out the previous viceroy, who was the general who was running the thing, who wanted to hold elections. And he said, no, we're not going to do it. And at that point, there was still an intact middle class in Iraq. And said, no, we're going to turn Iraq into a neoconservative paradise to prove that the conservative ideals, the conservative economics, will produce democracy. You guys had your chance after World War II, Truman and Roosevelt. After World War II, with the Marshall Plan, you rebuilt Europe, you rebuilt Germany, you rebuilt Japan, you helped them rewrite their constitutions, you gave them strong protections for labor, you gave them strong environmental protections, you gave them workplace security, you gave them national health care systems, all of those things that Republicans and conservatives have been absolutely opposed to in the United States since the 1920s and before. And, Germany and Japan turned out to be the second and third most powerful economies in the world. So we're going to prove to you that was just a fluke. So in Iraq, we're going to do what we want to do in the United States. And it's going to flower. It's going to blossom. It's going to be, and this is why I say the result that Bush has right now in Iraq is not the result he wants. Because they really believed that if they went into Iraq and they changed the laws so that cheap labor could be imported absolutely under all circumstances with no restrictions. In other words, any company could bring in people from Bangladesh or from Sri Lanka to work for half the price of Iraqis. And if the Iraqis didn't like it, tough luck. Hey, the corporation is profitable. That's a good thing for society. And so they did away with laws, with essentially what we would call in the United States immigration laws. Did away with them. They said these old rules that corporations have to keep their money in the country. Yeah, do away with that. Old rules that only Iraqis can own the company. No, do away with that. Let multinational companies come in and do their business here and take all of their profits out of the country. They don't have to leave it behind. Do away with the minimum wage. Do away with labor unions. These are the things that Paul Bremer did in the first few months after the end of the Iraqi invasion and the beginning of the Iraqi occupation. And the result was not the marvelous democracy that the cons and the neocons thought would happen. The result was exactly what you see right now. The destruction of the middle class, 60% unemployment, and a country devolving into chaos and civil war. And that's the direction they want to push the United States. So now here comes this vote about the minimum wage. The Democrats have been for some time saying, let's raise the minimum wage to $7.25 an hour. You know, just about half the states in the United States have already done something similar to this. Let's do it at a federal level. And they're going to make it an election issue in 2006. And so the Republicans say, no, we're going to take that away from you as an election issue. We're going to allow there to be a vote on raising the minimum wage to $7.25. But! See, there's always a but when the cons want to let there be a vote on something like the minimum wage. But we're going to attach this thing that, quote, will make it easier for small businesses to band together and buy health insurance plans for employers at a lower cost, end quote. Right. In fact, what this is going to do, they're going to attach, these are called AHPs, Association Health Plans. They're going to attach this to the minimum wage bill in all probability. And what this is going to do is it's going to cause there to be an increase of uninsured Americans by the millions. And only about one in five small employers would have lower premiums, while four out of five small companies are going to see their premiums go up. In other words, there's another giveaway to the health insurance industry in exchange for an increase in the minimum wage. And it's just, it's absolutely mind-boggling. Coming up Monday, I'll be challenging conservative Timothy Carney on his new book, The Big Ripoff, How Big Business and Big Government Steal Your Money. And Mark Carlin from BuzzFlash.com is going to be stopping by for the best of the rest of the news. That and more, and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks for listening to us this today and every day here. And remember, my friends, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.